In this episode of the Music Bed Podcast, we chat with Grammy Award-winning music video director, Calmatic. He's worked with artists like Anderson .Paak, Kendrick Lamar, and Lil Nas X.
When I did O-Town Road, like, I was directing Chris Rock. You know, Lil Nas X is, like, running away with the money, and they stop chasing him. And Chris Rock says, like,
"When you see a black man on a horse going that fast, you just gotta let him fly."
Recently, he just completed his first two feature films, House Party and White Men Can't Jump.
You know, I felt like every day I learned something new that I wish I knew the day before. I'm like, man, if I knew that yesterday, like that scene would have been way better. I understood, like, this is what filmmaking is. Filmmaking is learning from your mistakes.
Yeah.
And the more you learn, the less mistakes you make. And, you know, because there's going to always be mistakes.
This podcast is a production of MusicBed, the standard in music licensing for film, TV, and advertising. To create your free account today, go to musicbed.com.
We are sitting here with Calmatic. Can I call you Chuck?
Yeah, you can call me Chuck.
Do people call you Calmatic?
People obviously call me Calmatic, but
yeah,
it's because I was trying to start a business when I first started doing film,
yeah,
and it was called Calmatic. And so when people saw, like, the YouTube page was called Calmatic, they just assumed that was my name. Like, I've never put, like, directed by Calmatic, and they just started calling me Calmatic, and I just never stopped them. So it's kind of my fault.
Does it mean something?
So, you know, I come from music, right? Like, I used to make beats and I used to rap. And I remember back in, like, what was it, like 2008-ish, there was, like, this thing where everyone was remixing Jay-Z's Black Album.
Okay.
Remember, they did the Beatles. It was, like, the Gray Album. And so it was, like, the whole remix thing. And so I was like, all right, I'm a producer. I'm from the West Coast. But my favorite album is Illmatic. I'm going to make a remix album where I put Nas Illmatic over West Coast beats. And I'm going to call it Calmatic. And so when I started my YouTube page, I didn't know what username to put. So I just put Calmatic just as a temporary thing, and it just stuck. So
you did Rich Spirit, right? Like, how did that come about? Like, tell me that story.
Man, so I've known Kendrick and his creative collaborator, Dave Free, for a long time. Going back to, like, you know, 2009, even before right before I got my camera, I was just a fan. And I remember, like, tweeting, like, why is @KendrickLamar so slept on?
Yeah.
And then he responded to me like, man, it's because the industry hasn't really caught up to what I'm doing. And I was like, yeah, bro, it's crazy. And I remember telling him, like, yo, bro, I'm a director. I'll do some music videos to help you. Like, I'll do it for free. And then we connected back then. I did a video for Cut You Off, mm-hmm, and a video for, he did this freestyle called Over Kanye's Beat. It's called the Monster Freestyle.
And so that wasn't the first time you guys had worked together.
No. And it's funny because, like, ever since then, like, I think, like, right after he did Monster Freestyle, that's when it took off. And obviously I'm a fan of his music, but also I'm like, I'm doing music videos too, bro. So every album that came out, as soon as the album came out, I'll just write a treatment to, like, damn near every song. Like, all right, I gotta get a video on Kendrick. Every album, as soon as a new album come out, all right, boom, 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 writing treatments. And, like, it never really connected. It's funny because at this point I'm like, all right, you know what? Let me just kind of sit back and just, like, be a fan and not worry about doing a video for, you know, this next album. Even on the back of my head, I'm like, damn, I should write something for that. I'm like, nah, don't put yourself in that position again. Out of the blue, I get a call from Dave, who's this creative guy. He's like, yo, we need some videos. And I think, you know, for me, the way I approach, you know, working with Kendrick is like, man, I am a fan. And I think about, like, if I was a fan, what would I want to see? When he came out with the Heart Part 5 video, mm-hmm, I remember my mind was just so blown, not by the visual effects and, like, the, you know, face changing and all that shit.
Yeah.
It was more so, like, his performance as Kendrick. You know, you kind of saw him tap into a different level of emotion and, like, vulnerability. And he did almost seem, like, possessed, so to speak. You know, mm-hmm, what I'm saying? And I remember when we were doing Rich Spirit, you know, I remember thinking, like, all right, so in this part, when you turn into the mirror and you perform, I want you to give me that yeah, shit from the Heart, yeah, Part 5. Whatever the fuck that is that kind of brought out some type of emotion inside of me, I need you to bring that out again, because as a fan, we love seeing that shit.
How does he respond when you say that?
It's funny because, like, I've kind of developed this thing like, oh, Kendrick is like just so elevated and so, and then when I looked in his face and I'm like in between takes, we'll just be hanging out and I'm looking at him, I'm like, yo, this is the same exact dude from, you know, 2010, you know, the dude that we had to like pick up because he didn't have the car. You know what I mean? It's the same person. He's just been consistent and has gotten to this level, so to speak. And so, you know, talking to him, he's receptive as he was back in the day. Like, he's not like, no, I'm not doing that or whatever. You know what I mean? And I think like that probably plays a big part of his success is that he's willing to be coached, so to speak. And he surrounds himself with people that get it. You know, I feel like him hiring me after all these years is like, you know, a sign that he trusts my, you know, vision and how I see it. It's like, I'm dreaming that I'm the head coach of the Lakers and I'm giving LeBron a play to go execute. And he goes, executes it to a T.
Yeah.
That's how it was with Kendrick, where it's like, yo, I get to tell. It's like telling Michael Jackson, like, all right, I want you to go over there and moonwalk and then like, and like throw your hat and then grab your crouch. Right. And then he just goes and does, you know what I'm saying? And so, you know, I hope that I'm able to continue to work with him and kind of elevate even more with him and tap into a different level of creativity. Cause as a fan, there's still things that I want to see out of Kendrick that I haven't seen. And I feel qualified to be able to like have that conversation with him and be able to articulate and brainstorm so that we can get that, because, you know, I represent a million other fans out in the world. And, you know,
that's such a cool way to think about it, dude.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times with directors, there's a lot of ego.
Yeah.
Where you think that your vision is so singular and specific that you bring a lot of ego to the project.
This podcast is a production of MusicBed, the standard in music licensing for film, TV, and advertising. From indie artists on the rise to leading composers, MusicBed has curated the best roster of musicians for your films. Go to musicbed.com and use the promo code CALMATIC to get your first month free on a standard subscription.
I take pride in like being a fan of the artists that I work with, you know. I don't, like, if you look at all my videos, I guarantee you the song is a good song.
Was it always that way? Like, speaking a little practically, people who want to be doing music videos, how do you specifically build your portfolio in the earlier days to, like, have that ability to choose and make sure that you're only working with good music?
My story, you know, began with me making music and making a certain type of music. And, you know, that's kind of how I got into making music videos. I was like, I'm a tech guy, right? And so when I'm around all these artists like Anderson .Paak and Tyler, the Creator, and Dom Kennedy, and, you know, whoever, I'm also the guy that knows how to like upload their music to MySpace or like make like a HTML design, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, and like, or like do a flyer for their show tonight. And so I was always right there. And so once I got my video camera, I was just like, all right, well, instead of making a flyer, let's go make a music video. And so, you know, word got around that like, oh, like Chuck makes videos. Like, let's go and see what that's about. I was doing them for free. So like, you know, no one was losing anything. And, you know, it was all just proximity, to be honest.
I was going to ask, like, how does music, even to this day, find its way into your work or your process?
I think about music so much. Every single day, I'm like, I wake up in the morning like, man, I love music. And I'm not a big film buff. Like, I don't.
Sure.
There's so many actors that are like, everyone knows my Apple. I'm like, I don't know who that is. Like, I don't know anybody's name. I don't know directors. I don't know, like, you know, that. But I could tell you every producer, every engineer, every, you know, rapper on all these albums. So I kind of like to say that I'm not really a hardcore filmmaker. I'm more so like a musician or someone who is in love with music that just so happens to be making film right now. And so no matter what I do in my life, like, music is a part of it. And so how I like to implement it into film is, you know, it's all about a feeling, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I think the type of music that I do indulge myself in is off kilter, like funky, like just crazy, like, you know, weird type shit. I try to make sure that my films feel the way those things sound.
Yeah.
I edit 98% of my music videos. And
oh, wow.
Yeah. And the way I edit is the same way I make a beat. You know, I'm not cutting everything to like the one and the two and the cut and cut and cut, cut, cut.
The one ands and like
it's the one and it's the, it's like the off beat, or it's like, you know, J Dilla, his hi-hats are just like always a little drunk and not perfect,
right,
not quantized. Like, I like to edit that way. And obviously, it doesn't really, the sound doesn't necessarily translate to like an edit or a cut in a film or a picture.
But it's a rhythm. You're like feeling it.
Yeah, but it's like a silent rhythm that you can just feel. You know what I'm saying? Like your eyes, it's almost like listening with your eyes, so to speak. You know what I mean? I try to implement that into everything I'm doing, even with the film. Every day when I know what scenes are coming up that day, I always try to pick a song in the morning that I like having my headphones all day just to kind of get that rhythm out. You know what I'm saying? And like, sometimes it might be a weird ass song. It might be, you know, some classical music. It might be some instrumental music. It might even be like a sugar-free song. I kind of like let that energy, you know, dictate how I direct and like what the rhythm is and the mood is for that day. And even like, you know, with dialogue and things in a narrative space, like sometimes I don't even look at a scene in playback. Sometimes I just listen, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, I kind of have this theory that if it sounds good, it probably looks good. You know what I'm saying? And I think a lot of times when you're watching, you know, the scene play out, you're kind of just looking at all this other shit. You're making sure that the things in the background look right and the hand gestures are right. But like, you're not really listening. You know what I'm saying? And so I think like I've realized that, you know, even as a director, I'll come in and give an actor a note and I'm just like, can you just like change that word and just make it a little bit less perfect, you know. I even have a struggle like articulating like how to translate this thing that I hear to them. But you know, sometimes I even send them that song in the morning so that they can know like this is the energy that we're on. You know what I'm saying?
100%.
So yeah, it's a work in progress, and I think it's definitely a different way to approach filmmaking. But like I said, I didn't go to film school, but like I've made 1,000 beats in my life. I've listened to 1 billion songs. And I think, you know, they say that film is the sum of all arts, right? They say that, you know, film has music, dance, like lighting, photography, like every art is like a part of film. And I think like my strong point is music. And so I feel like, or just sound and the way things sound audibly and feel audibly. And I think if I can lean into that, then everything else will kind of catch up to that.
I got into a mode because I do the same thing with music, but I would give it to operators, like a Steadicam
or
a Dolly op or something like that, because it informs so much, man.
Man, there's this interview. There's a DP by the name of Arthur Jaffa.
Okay.
And he was the DP on, I think he might have been a DP on Belly, or part of Belly. He did, you know, a bunch of films back in the day. And he was talking about how he likes to create a shorthand with his collaborators. And usually that shorthand isn't something that's like something that they teach in film school. It's just like a cultural reference that they share. So he was like, you know, even if they're filming like an action movie, you know, if you tell the cameraman, yo, I want the camera to move how Jordan dunks. You know what I mean? Or how Iverson crosses, you know, how Iverson crossed over Jordan. I need the camera to feel that. Like, it may not translate perfectly, but they know it's like a little bit of hesitation and a little bit of like rise. And then once you get past Jordan, how do you finish at the hoop? Like, you know what I mean? It's like that type of like conversation that I like to, you know, just like make sure that everyone is on the same page with it. And through music is how you find that connection through people. Like if I, you know, you're an Eminem fan and I'm like, yo, I want this to feel like, I don't want this to feel like Slim Shady. I want this to feel like Marshall Mathers.
Right.
Like, you know what that is.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little more sophisticated, a little more mature. It's still crazy. It's a little darker, but it's not like
more serious.
It's not that zany. You know what I'm saying? So
no, that's so cool. Diving into music videos a little bit more, I'd be remiss personally if we didn't talk about Bubbling, which I feel is like, it's just one of my favorite music videos. I watch that music video all the time.
Yeah.
One, because like you said, it's such a good song, but there's very rare moments where a music video like matches the song.
Yeah.
But with a music video like Bubbling, which is Anderson .Paak, if you haven't seen it, you have to see it. Give me the story of how you guys met, but how did that music video come about? And
when I first got my camera, you know, before I was doing music videos for artists, I would just go around to all these different events and like capture them. I used to go to this open mic night in Leimert Park. It was an event called Bananas. And, you know, I would, you know, film whoever was who was performing, or, you know, if they were super dope, I would like take them outside and film like a little freestyle and like put it on my YouTube page. And I remember like going in there and filming, and I remember like there was like a, keep in mind, these are just like rappers, right? Just like dudes spitting.
Yeah.
And I go in there and it's like a dude playing the drums. And I'm just like, who the f- playing the drums at like an open mic? Like no one does that. And he not only is he like on the drums and like killing the drums, but he's also rapping at the same time and also like singing at the same time. And like there's girls in the crowd that are like swooning and who are normally just be there like going like, yeah,
right,
hip hop, you know what I'm saying? And so it was just like, what the f-? So, you know, I remember filming him being like blown away by it. And, you know, right after the performance, I took him to the side and I was like, yo, bro, like, what the f-? Like, you need to be on like the Guinness Book of Records. Like, you need to be on like Ripley's Believe It or Not or some shit. You know what I'm saying? Like, America's Got Talent. And he was like, yeah, man, you know, he actually knew about the videos I had been, that I had been making with this group called Overdose, like at that time. And so he already knew kind of who I was. And I was just a fan, same way I was with Kendrick. And, you know, he started doing more and more music. And I remember one day he called me like, yo, I got this song. I want to do a music video for it. I was like, man, I gotta go to San Francisco tonight. Like, but also at the same time, I didn't even have any money to get to San Francisco. I had like maybe like $100 or something like that. He was like, I'll pay you. And that was my first time getting paid for a music video. He paid me $300 to come to this like random apartment to film this video that actually never even came out because we didn't finish it because I had to go to San Francisco. And so I took that $300 from him, went to San Francisco, and then, you know, 2 weeks passed and we just kind of stopped talking to each other. It was weird. But keep in mind, he's still going and he's still seeing me work. And he's like, yo, bro, as soon as I get the budget, like, we're going to tap into each with one another. You know, he's like getting bigger and bigger. And, you know, he came out with this song called Suede, and he reached out to me and he was like, yo, let's do a video. After that, we did the video for Come Down, which was like a kind of like a slightly bigger video budget wise. But then right around that time when he did Come Down, that's when the Dr. Dre thing happened.
Yeah.
And it was like, yo, he's out of here. And, you know, he had this single bubbling and they wanted me to write a treatment for it. He was like, yo, once I get this budget, like, I'm coming to you. And so he came to me and, like, you know, at first the treatment, that original treatment that I wrote, it was like, it was a play on what's that movie? Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
It was like, it was supposed to be him and Issa Rae sitting at a diner. And all of us, and they start arguing, and all of a sudden in the middle of the argument, they like rob the diner, they got a bunch of money, and they just like go to Vegas and blow the money. Like, that was the whole thing. And I remember like Anderson .Paak loved it. Like, we had Issa Rae, she was, you know, ready to go. And I had to meet Dr. Dre and like break it down to him. And so I remember going to his castle. I don't even want to call it his mansion. Going to Dr. Dre's house. It was just me and him. It was so crazy. It was just me and him. We were sitting there and I kind of broke down the treatment. He was like, cool. All right. Yeah, let's do it. And then I leave his house, and like less than 5 minutes after I leave his house, I get a text from his manager, from Anderson .Paak's manager, that said like, Dre doesn't like the treatment. And I'm like, I literally just left his house. Like, I can see his house. I can see his castle in the distance in my rearview mirror. Like, and he didn't really give a reason why he didn't like it necessarily. He just did. He said it. He actually didn't say like cancel the video. He was just like, it's cool, but like, I think you guys can do better.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? But go ahead. If you think this is it, do it. And so I remember thinking like, I think he's right. Like, it is a little basic.
That's like, what I said. Like, in a way, it's kind of like dope that he.
Yes. Yeah, like, it was a blessing in disguise. And I remember thinking like, all right, man, like, people need to really know, like, as a fan, going back to being as a fan, people need to know how fun Anderson .Paak is.
Yeah.
He's one of the funniest people. Like, he could be a comedian if he really wanted to, you know what I'm saying? And he's just so talented, like, physically, and like, he has great comedic timing. Like, let's have fun with this shit. And so I remember, you know, I'm like a reference connoisseur. I got folders and folders and folders and folders of just like random ass references. And so I was like, man, it's cool if they like rob this diner and have a bunch of money, but like, let's make the video more about how they spend the money
right,
versus them going to Vegas and getting in the shootout with somebody. You know what I'm saying? And so I went through that folder and I was just looking at all these images and like thinking like, okay, how can I translate this image to something that has to do with the story? How can I translate this? How can I translate this? How can I? And so I started coming up with all these different images. And one of the images was someone at a bank, at an ATM. It wasn't even like the ATM coming out or anything, like right. the money coming out. It was right. just somebody at an ATM. And I was like, damn, what if the whole video was that he went to the bank and he, you know, tried to get some money out the ATM and like all the money from the ATM came out. But not only that, like it constantly came out and he actually ends up taking the ATM with him and like going on a crazy ass, like, you know, journey with the ATM.
Yeah.
And so I took all those references that I was looking up before I got to the ATM and I applied the new idea to those and that shit all just like synced up.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, you know, a image of like someone swimming in a pool and like jumping in the pool. And I was like, well, what if the pool is full of money?
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like there's that Salvador Dali image where he's like holding a book, he has six arms and he's like holding a book, has a paintbrush, eating something with like his other hand. And mm-hmm. I was like, man, what would it take for him to have six arms? Maybe he took the money from the ATM and like bought some arms, yeah. whatever, you know what I mean? And so we just kind of like had all these references and we just like, you know, made sure that we didn't like repeat anything in the video. We never went back to scenes. We never
right.
duplicated anything. And we just wanted every moment to just be like new and fresh and just like fun.
Yeah.
So I don't know, man. It was one of those things where like I couldn't believe we were doing what we were doing, but it turned out to be probably one of the biggest moments in my career just to kind of show the range, but also to do it with someone like Anderson .Paak who can execute perfectly. And it's just a joy to be around and joy to work with. So
you got the Grammy for, was it Old Town Road?
Old Town Road, yeah.
So, I mean, Old Town Road has something like 800 million views or something like that.
Nah, that shit is like billions.
Is it bit?
Well, there's two different videos. There's the video that's like the long form, and that shit has like 800 million. And then there's a version that's just like the song only, without the little the story at the beginning,
right,
and
okay.
that has like a billion or something. So it's almost like 3 billion probably, like if you combine those.
I mean, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, like, did you know, like, did you get a sense of like what that was gonna become?
Nah, man. I mean, at the time, you know, I had just I'd just done Bubbling. So what happened was I got married and I went on a honeymoon in Japan. And so I was like not working for like 2 months.
Yeah.
And so when I came back, I was like, all right, I need to get back in the flow of writing treatments and like, you know, letting, you know, the people at the labels know that I'm back working. And so they sent me that video. They sent me that song. And I remember the day they sent it to me. Like, I remember I have the email. I need to frame this email, but they sent it to me and I responded to them. Is this a joke?
Really?
Like, yeah. And I wasn't like serious, like, oh, it's just a joke. Like, don't send me this shit. It was more like what? Like, I never heard. Like, I can't believe this is a song that you're sending me from an artist from Atlanta, you know, in 2019 or whatever. You know what I'm saying? And so I was like, you know what? Fuck it. I need to get back in the flow of things. Let me just like get my brain going and just write a treatment. I'm probably not going to get this. So let me just write it exactly how I would do it if I had the opportunity to do it. You know, being he was from Atlanta and at the time I was a huge fan of the show Atlanta. I was like, man, what would be dope is like, or wouldn't it be dope if it was an episode of Atlanta where a cowboy from the past came back to like claim his land.
Yeah.
And everybody in Atlanta was like, what the fuck? Like, who is this dude? You know what I'm saying? Yeah. But also it's also like how the quote unquote hood will react to that. Right. So like, you know, they probably be looking at his gun, like being like, damn, that's a big ass gun. Or, you know, the kids will be, you know, trying to pet the horse or, you know, people will be filming it or, you know, somebody has like a crazy, like a muscle car and they want to race their car versus the horse. You
right,
know what I mean?
Right.
Like just like hood shit that people will probably do. And I wrote the treatment and Lil Nas, he through it super hard. I was just like, all right, let's do it. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And it's weird because at the time that I think the day that I wrote the treatment was the day that like it became like the number one song.
Yeah.
And so I didn't really like as I was creating it, I didn't think it was a big deal. And then as we're preparing for it, it kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. I mean,
so
and
that
bigger.
Tells me that they didn't even know.
Oh no, they didn't know. Like they didn't know at all. Yeah. I mean, they kind of knew that it was picking up steam on like the social media end, yeah. but like for it to like break through the way it did, it hit a whole new level as we were filming. The day that we started filming, it was a Friday. And so we filmed Friday and then we had a break on Saturday and Sunday. And then on Monday we continued filming. And so that first Friday, he was like super nervous, like not really making eye contact with the camera, just like really just like anxious. Like I remember him coming to me like, man, you think this is going to work? Like, and then that weekend he performed at Stagecoach out in Coachella.
Wow.
And that was his first time ever performing the song. And it was in front of like, you know, 500,000 people, and they all knew the words. And I think that was the moment where he felt like, okay, this is real. And then on Monday, he came back to set with a blunt in his mouth, like, yo, what's up, Cal? What we doing, man? Let's get it. What we waiting on? Let's go. You know what I'm saying? And like, I think that was like, that was the moment where I was like, oh yeah, this shit is different. You know what I'm saying? And it's funny because like at the time he didn't really have any managers around. He was just like regular. Like he was talking about moving to LA. It was like all new, but like I don't think he even realized at the time that he would probably have the biggest song of all time. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? So, but I think that's dope. I think the way we approached it, the raw way that we approached it, benefited the song even more. You know, if we would have shot this video, you know, when it broke, you know, Mariah right. Carey's record, who knows how, you know, that would have influenced the creative. But I just wanted to keep it raw and reference the things that I, as a creative, and he as a creative, felt dear to us. And it's, you know, proof that the world can accept this and digest this and like they like it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Dude, so you have like a lot of narrative elements in your music videos.
Yeah.
And obviously there's a purpose within the music video, but it's because you kind of love narrative stuff. Like you love adding narrative stuff, but I'd love to know how that sort of helped in the journey to, you know, House Party and White Man Can't Jump. Like,
well, yeah, I mean, once again, it's like being a fan, right? I think one of my favorite music videos is, More Money, More Problems with Mace and Diddy. Mm-hmm. And I remember my favorite part of that video was in the middle of the video, they just cut out of it and like went to like some weird golf tournament.
Yeah.
where Mace was like Mace Gumbel and Diddy was, you know, Puffy Woods or something. And then the beat came back in, you know what I mean? Yeah. And I felt like we kind of lost that energy in our era of music videos. And so I wanted to always, you know, try to create stories and take things deeper, but it also kind of helps the music, right? It kind of like gives you a chance to kind of play with the sound and take things out and bring them back in and make moments in the music feel more impactful that way. You know what I mean? It's just something I fell in love with. I mean, I think I've never done a short film. I've never done like, you know, a student film or, you know, those.
Bro, what do you got against short films, man?
You said what?
What do you got against short films?
Oh no, I don't have anything. I want to do some short films. Like,
I just think it's crazy that you jumped so hard into features without,
yeah,
like, was there any nerves of you going like, what, should I test some of this stuff out? Like, should
no,
I?
It's because I've done narrative stuff in my music videos.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like I kind of use that. It's funny because like once I knew that I was like potentially a candidate to like to direct House Party, I was like, I thought the same way you thought, like, shit, I need to do some short films or like something, a documentary or something. And then, but I was like, no, I got these videos here. Let me create a narrative moment here. You know what I'm saying?
That's cool.
Same thing I did with Bubbling. If you look at Bubbling, there's the scene where, you know, the girl's on the date with the ATM.
Yep.
And like, that was like, that's a scene, you know what I'm saying? Over the shoulder wide, you know what I mean? And so I made it a point to like put that into all my music videos, so if that conversation did come up, they could look at my music videos at that as proof of concept, so to speak. And even like, you know, when I did Old Town Road, I was directing Chris Rock,
right?
Like I wrote that. Like there's a joke that Chris Rock says when he says, you know, Lil Nas X is like running away with the money and they stop chasing him, and Chris Rock says like, if you see a black man running that fast, you just gotta let him go. Like, I wrote that, you know what I'm saying? Like I wrote that joke and he liked it, you know what I'm saying? And I'm like, yeah, like if I could write a joke for Chris Rock, film him, direct him, have this whole sequence, and like I can do a movie. I can do this 80 more times, you know what I'm saying? And so that was kind of like my approach to it, is just like, you know, I've been given the opportunity to like fuck up and like learn on the fly. And like, I'm not a perfect filmmaker. Like there's a lot of mistakes that I make in all my projects, all my music videos, all my films. I'm like, fuck, I wish I would have did that. But like, I'm blessed enough to like get the opportunity to kind of like prove myself once again. And I think that's how I'm approaching my career, is like, I'm not going to ever be a perfect filmmaker. I'm going to always try new things. And then over the course of those, you know, trial and error moments, you know, I'll become the filmmaker that I'm supposed to become, right, so to speak.
So how long was the production on House Party? How long Joe Sheet did?
Man, House Party was crazy, man. So House Party was 30 days, right?
It's not that long.
Nah, but check this out. It was 30 days. But then in the maybe day 22 or something, we had to replace one of our leads.
What?
Yeah, we had to replace one of our leads. I can't get into why, but we had to replace one of our leads. So we had to reshoot maybe 15 days.
Oh,
after
my
we already shot it.
God.
So it ended up being 50 days. Yeah, bruh.
Whoa.
Yeah, so that's why I tell people all the time, I literally felt like doing House Party was like being on the episode of Scared Straight Hollywood Edition. you know the meme where they show the big buff dudes wake the kid up out of the bed and what's up? I feel like a big Hollywood bully came up to me and was like, "You want to make a movie? All right, well, yeah. I'm gonna give you a beloved title that everyone's gonna judge before they even see the movie. I'm gonna make you have to replace the main actor in the middle of the movie when you're almost done.
Yeah.
It's gonna be COVID and it's gonna be a house party, so that means you only can have 10 people in it's all these obstacles that anyone would have quit. You know, I had to deal with those. And you know, I felt like every day I learned something new that I wish I knew the day before.
Of course.
I'm like, man, if I knew that yesterday, that scene would have been way better. Damn, if I knew that yesterday, damn it. You know what I'm saying? And so at the end of it all, I felt like I collected so many lessons and I understood this is what filmmaking is. Filmmaking is learning from your mistakes.
Yeah.
And the more you learn, the less mistakes you make. And, you know, because there's going to always be mistakes. You know, it's a miracle that people make a movie, let alone a great movie. You know what I'm saying? And so, you know.
Isn't that such a cool revelation? Because I've had the exact same revelation after you finish a movie. You're like, the idea that anybody makes a movie is a miracle.
And it's so funny too, because obviously when you're in a creative and you're watching films, you're critiquing shit.
Yeah,
why is he dressed like that? Why is her hair what is this lighting? And it's like when you make a movie, you understand exactly how all that shit happened. And it's not always things as a director, it's not always things that are in your control. You know, it's funny, you know, we had to reshoot a lot of scenes for a House Party. And so, you know, I kind of took that as all right, cool. I get to make scenes better and look back and see my mistakes. But also when we went back to shoot certain scenes, you know, the first time we shot it, it was clear skies. And now this time we shoot it, it's overcast and cloudy and it's about to rain. And so it was even though I'm able to make the scene feel better, there's gray skies. You know what I'm saying? And so it's you can't control every, all those elements. You just kind of have to deal with whatever, you know, you get dealt that day.
It gives you real reverence for the movies that you love.
That too.
You know what I mean?
But also you also realize that the movies you love, it wasn't the creators are just so locked in and planned everything.
It's kind of a universe.
It's
thing.
God was on their side and they made certain things happen. And so, you know,
So you didn't have to go shoot. You didn't just go back to the scenes and shoot that coverage. You shot the entire thing.
Yeah,
over
because
again.
This whole scene was based on, you know, this one person. So it's anything that had that person in it, we had to reshoot it. And luckily we didn't have to reshoot the whole movie. So, you know, but the crazy thing is when we brought in the new actor, he had to start at the end of the movie, you know, with 10 days left and then go back and shoot the beginning of his story. Right. So it was just, it was a lot, man. It was a journey. But even, you know, going, it's funny because I started shooting White Man Can't Jump, another remake, you know, 3 months after I wrapped the edit for House Party. And so I was able to just apply those lessons right
then
and there.
Doesn't that feel so good, dude?
Oh my God. And it's so funny because obviously, House Party is my first movie, but I kind of look at White Man Can't Jump as my first movie as well.
That's
you know, it's 1.5. You know what I'm saying? I made some mistakes in that film. You know what I'm saying? But hopefully on my next film, I'll be able to apply what I learned from those mistakes.
Yeah. Dude, what was the biggest mistake that you made that you got to apply or sort of take lesson from?
I think, and this is no jab at anything that House Party House Party had or anything, but I didn't really take charge of creating the shot list. I left it up to my DP, Andrew Huchner, who was amazing DP. And obviously I had input on the shot list, but it was just I wish I was a lot more hands-on, because there were certain things that I wanted, but I was like, nah, he knows better because he's been doing this for years. And so when I watch certain scenes, I'm like, damn, I wish I would have got that close-up. And it's no one's fault but mine, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, coming into House Party, I mean, to White Man Can't Jump, you know, me and the DP Maddox Upshaw, who's amazing, we shot list the whole movie before we even started. And like I created the shot list, and you know, he added his two cents, and like, you know, on the day he would take my shot list and make it better, you know what I'm saying, as he should. But like, I took control over that, and I think overall, like, this movie is gonna feel more like a film, you know what I'm saying, because I think I tapped into certain things that I felt like House Party was missing. You know what I'm saying? I learned lessons as a shot, like making my own shot list, that like, okay, maybe this shot you think you want, you don't need that.
Yeah.
And there's stuff that Andrew from House Party implemented into our shot list that I was like, oh yeah, I see why he did that, because, you know, we need this to establish this moment or whatever like that. So, you know, it's just a lesson as far as like how much power I have and how I should take advantage of that and like really try to get what I want, but also be open to working with, you know, the DP and making sure that, you know, it's not just me that's dictating what everything looks and feels like.
It's so funny that you jumped straight into like two back-to-back, like beloved titles, like you said.
It's crazy.
What is some of the baggage that comes with a remake of something of that caliber?
You know what? To be honest, man, like I know people look at the studio or like the... I think one thing people have to realize too, like when it comes to like the studio, whether it be Warner Brothers or Fox or Disney, people think it's like a boardroom of like 100 people like making a decision.
Yeah.
It's like three people.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's like Steve and Colin, like those are the guys at Fox. You know what I'm saying? They're just like cool guys. And it's not like they're like, you know, down my throat, like make sure that this, you know, lives up to the original. Like they just want to make a movie. They're creative just like we are. And as far as like, you know, tying things into the remake of it all, like that's not really a thought. Like there's no baggage there. I think the biggest thing that, you know, the studio wants is like, you know, a cameo from the original cast, you know what I'm saying? Which we may or may not have in the next film that's coming out. But
are you saying you got Woody Harrelson?
You gotta find out. But
bro, just tell us, bro. Break it here.
Yeah, there's like this one-on-one scene with like Woody Harrelson and Jack Harlow. They're just like going at it for like 40 minutes straight, and then we start the movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, man, it's I think at the end of the day, like, to be honest, like, I know there's a lot of talk about remakes and all that kind of shit, but I think that Hollywood is in a weird position right now where they need to make money to keep going. You know what I mean? And they aren't in a position to take that many risks with like a major, you know, studio budget. You know what I'm saying? And so the name is what gets people going to the theaters.
Yeah.
Like that's the end of, or it gets people talking. You know, if the LeBron movie wasn't called, or if the House Party movie was called like the LeBron Mansion thingy, like less people would be interested. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And that's just the truth. Obviously they do need to take more chances, but the reality is, you know, they have a formula and this formula works for them.
Yeah. Man, if there's a sort of one lesson, what's something that you kind of have found in the last couple of years that you're going to take into the future?
I think I want to be more selfish as a creator. And what I mean by that is like, you know, when you're making something that you feel is for a broad audience, you have a tendency to kind of cater to everybody to make sure that they understand what's going on and that they know that they get that reference and they, you know, whatever. But I learned that, you know, all the great filmmakers, whether it be Spike or Martin or, you know, whoever, they're really selfish about the world that they show us. Yeah. They show us what they think is cool. They play the music that they think is cool. They cast the characters that resonate with them and speak that inside language that they appreciate.
Yeah.
And you know, it's tough because you feel like, man, ain't nobody gonna get that. Like, that's just something that I know. And it's like, yeah, but you can, if you present it in the right way, you know, you'll realize that the world does understand it. And you'll also teach the world your language. And, you know, I feel like, you know, Hollywood might realize that like I'm not a great director and my last movie is White Man Can't Jump. at least I could look back and say I did it my way.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, to me, that's the most important part. And I don't think that's going to happen. Like, I'm clearly going to do more, you know, projects. But, you know, if I look at it that way, I can feel, you know, satisfied with myself that I did it how I wanted to do it. And I didn't try to play the game.
Dude, give me some background real quick on House Party. How did that come about? How did you get to talk with the writers and stuff?
You know, like, I come from music, right? And so, you know, the group that I was doing a lot of music videos for, they did a song with Childish Gambino. Mm-hmm. And so I developed a relationship with Childish Gambino's manager, who is from L.A., like went to Crenshaw High School, and he was a fan of my work. We were just kind of like, I think I worked on a couple Childish Gambino projects here and there. But then, you know, one day they announced that, you know, the writers from Atlanta, Stephen Glover and Jamal, they were writing the House Party script. So I literally went to my DMs and Instagram right away and was like, yo, I need first dibs on House Party. Yeah.
Which is funny because that's what you were doing with music videos.
Yeah, yeah.
And now you're like leveling up.
Exactly, right? Yeah, like, yeah, like if I hear a song, I'm like, yo, can I do a video? And I'm like, yo, you writing it? Can I do it? And I'm like, at the time, it was like Atlanta was just like, you know, like just popping, coming. Yeah. And I was like, oh yeah, I got to work with them on Atlanta. And to be honest, it's funny because he didn't even respond to me. And like, I knew him, but he still didn't respond. So yeah. I was like, whatever. And like over the course of that year, you know, I did Bubble In, I did Old Town Road, and I make sure to put that narrative, you know, moment in there just to make sure, like, if it came up, like I showed this as a proof of concept. And, you know, like, I think maybe like a year and a half later, they reached out like, yo, we want to set up a meeting with you and Spring Hill, LeBron's company who produced it. And, you know, we hit it off at the meeting and, you know, I basically told them, you know, just making it as personal as possible. Like, this story is an L.A. story. Like, I'm from L.A. I totally get what this story is. This is only L.A. is the only place where this could happen. You know what I mean? I kind of, you know, pitched them with that angle and they loved it, man. And, you know, the rest is history, man. So I shot my shot and it got me here on the couch to shoot, man.
So. Love it. So I'm going to ask you some rapid fire stuff to end this episode. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
What are three essential tools for your creative process? Tools that you use?
Like physical tools or like could ideas? Be. iPhone. Instagram. I know it sounds like the same thing, but those are two different things. And music.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's it.
Love it. What's your favorite scene, movie, or TV where music elevated the moment?
Wow. I mean, I feel like it had to be like the end of Malcolm X, where you know, Spike did like the double dolly shot as Malcolm is like going to, you know, his speech where he gets killed. I feel like Spike Lee, I feel like he's probably one of the best directors that like does that in film. He's just able to like really tap into that like soulful musical note that just kind of like makes your skin crawl in a good way. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. What's a piece of career advice that you wish you heard sooner?
Man, I just learned this recently too. It's like, the thing that you think you want to be doing, or the director you think you want to be, or the creator you think you want to be, you're already that right now. You just have to keep going and keep like, you know, leaning into who you are at this moment, and you'll eventually get there. It's not going to just change overnight. It starts with you recognizing that you have it already, and you eventually will meet that goal.
If you had to pick a different career, what would it be?
So I think that the old answer would be like the second baseman for the Dodgers or something like that. But like my new answer, like me and my wife will love this. I think I would be like an FBI agent or like an FBI investigator. Like I'm so good at like finding stuff on the internet, dog. Yeah. Like I'm just like I could probably find out where you live, like what high school you went to, everything. I'm just really good at like snooping around on the internet. So like I would love to get paid for that.
Yeah. What upcoming movies are you most excited, or movie specific, are you most excited about this year?
There's a few, but I think there's a film called They Clone Tyrone that Jamie Foxx is in, and Jonathan Boyega, and my boy Steve Lover is producing it as well. It's on Netflix. I'm looking forward to it. I feel like there are not a lot of movies that like tap into like the young black energy. Mm-hmm. I don't even want to say culture, but there's not a lot. And so I think that movie is going to really do, you know, some fun things.
What is the last song you listened to? Just like pull it up in your history.
Damn, what's the last song I listened to? This is going to be funny. Let's see. Oh, yeah. Iman Omari. Yeah, Energy. Yeah, Energy, Iman Omari. That's my boy.
Love it.
Iman Omari is like one of the dopest producers and songwriters. He just got like the craziest sounds, man. So, yeah, Iman Omari.
What is one book that you would recommend to any filmmaker?
It's not, I don't even know if I want to call it a book, but it's like a little like handbook. It's called Show Your Work.
Okay.
And it's a book about sharing your creative process with your quote unquote fan base or other people that you want to create with. Because the more, you know, you show your work, you know, people like following your journey with you. You know what I'm saying? And so if you just try to, you know, hide it and make it seem like you just, you know, you just started from scratch and you're already this great, people are, you know, less enthused to like support that. Mm-hmm. But if they see that you started from here and you worked your way up to where you are now, no matter how far you are, like, I think people are more likely to support and you know, follow your journey.
What's something you always bring to set?
A hat.
Always a hat?
Dude, always I did the same thing.
I'm a hat
always
guy.
A hat, man.
What is your dream collaboration?
Ooh, dream collaboration. I don't really know, man. I feel like my dream collaboration is like collaborating with my parents or my family to write something that's near and dear to them and to be able to like put it out there and for the world to see.
What's your guilty pleasure movie?
Oh, guilty pleasure movie. I don't even know if it's a guilty pleasure, but I love Forrest Gump, man. Forrest Gump is my favorite movie, dog. Like, I think it's like a perfect film. Like, yeah. It's just like, you got everything you need. Comedy, drama, like history. It's just shot well, good characters. It's just dope, man.
Love it. Yeah. Dude, thank you for being on the show, man.
Nah, thank you too, man. I appreciate it, bro. Appreciate it.
Next time on the Music Bed Podcast, we sit down with Academy Award-winning filmmakers Rika Zatopchi and Sam Davis.
Like, I was 25. It was the first time I'd ever made a documentary.
And the Oscar goes to, period, end of sentence.
And it happened so fast, and all of a sudden, it's like, the pressure of it, like, afterwards paralyzed me. I mean, it really, like, imposter syndrome was, like, a real thing.
This podcast is a production of MusicBed, the standard of music licensing for film, TV, and advertising. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with another filmmaker you know, and subscribe to be notified for the next episodes.